was a rainy day in the city by the bay. Time for another episode of Magnum Podcast. I'm Jason Snell. You'll find me often down at the morgue, checking out the dead bodies. I'm not a coroner. I just like watching the dead bodies. Joining me are two gumshoes that I've known for a long time. It's Philip Michaels and David Lohr. Hey there, boys.
Hey, Mr. Snell, it's good to see you again. Kind of not where I was expecting you to go with the dead bodies thing.
Let's speed this up. I'm late for the Anglo-Hawaiian royal costume brunch.
We are discussing Murder by Night, Season 7, Episode 14. An episode that is almost entirely set in a film noir setting in San Francisco, featuring Magnum's alter ego that we saw in a previous episode, and then we're now following up, where it's Thomas Magnum, private investigator, but he's a sort of a film noir investigator, investigating
in black and white.
Yeah. So this is the thing. This is the thing we have to get to. This is the quote unquote black and white episode of Magnum PI. Now, according to Magnum-Mania, the official Bible of the Magnum podcast, this episode has a very confusing history. It was apparently aired on CBS in black and white.
Yes.
With the exception of the final scene, which fades into color. However, all subsequent home video releases of this episode, the opening credits are in black and white. The end tag before it fades into color is in black and white. And the rest of the episode is just in color.
Yep.
And not realizing that until after I watched the episode, I was grumbling all throughout the episode. This episode is cowardly. Why aren't they doing it in black and white, fellas?
I still have the VHS from recording it when it originally aired, because I loved the fact that they were doing it in black and white, and because it was the same week or the same, like, two-week period as St. Elsewhere doing their Divine Comedy episode. It was a great month for weird TV episodes.
So, halfway through, I realized, while consulting Magnum-Mania.com, the official Bible of the Magnum podcast, that this episode really should be in black and white. And, yes, friends, I got out my little TV remote that I don't usually use, and I went to the picture settings, and I went to the color bar, and I took it all the way from 50 down to 0.
There you go.
And I watched the rest of the episode in black and white. And if you do think about watching Murder by Night, do that, because you know what?
Yeah.
It looks great in black and white.
It works better.
And that's how it's supposed to be.
And that's the thing. Every time I've seen it in reruns and syndication and Roku channel and DVD, it pisses me off because I would
assume when they syndicated the show, like your TV 20s in San Francisco and whatever your local terrible independent station that would air the show during the day, we're not going to show a black and white episode. People will get lots of calls.
That's exactly what I expected, is that they were afraid in syndication that the cowardly people at the CBS syndication or Universal syndication, I guess, wouldn't do it. And so they put out a color episode. And then I think maybe it was a game of telephone when they scanned in the film for the HD version and all of that. They must have either looked at the syndicated version for reference or just not known that what it was meant to be. Because it is actually kind of shocking that the HD version, that they didn't go realize, somebody didn't say, oh, this is actually meant to be in black and white. And it's just color film.
And the fact that it still has the opening segment in black and white, and then the whole point of that transition at the very end is to be like, oh, now we're in color. So it maintains the black and white portion of it,
which
is bizarre.
Which is very, very weird. Yeah, Magnum wakes up and he's like, oh, it's black and white.
but it's also shot to look good in black and white.
If you turn down the color, because I watched half of it in color and half of it in black and white. In color, it looks fine, but not particularly notable, but definitely it was lit for black and white. I would imagine that the preview monitors they had on set were black and white, because in black and white, it pops. It's gorgeous.
All of those colors look different. If you look at a side-by-side shot of the Dick Van Dyke Show set in black and white and color, it's hideous in color because it looks good in black and white.
Right.
And this was also, this episode came out at the time where really you had lunatics like Ted Turner pushing to colorize everything.
And it was
madness.
And for instance, Moonlighting also did a black and white episode.
I remember that one.
And it was a very good episode of that. But, you know, Moonlighting did not have the same syndication life as Magnum.
That's true.
No. And so, you know it didn't matter.
This is a little off. This is a little off as a tangent. But there was a story I read recently where somebody was talking about Moonlighting and mentioned that the fatal flaw of Moonlighting was that Sybil Shepherd and Bruce Willis got together during the shooting of the pilot. And the problem when you have stuff like that is that then when it comes back and they're not together anymore, and you've got your two stars that need to be romantic toward one another, and they no longer feel romantic toward one another at all that chemistry has kind of been lost or become negative, and that's one of the reasons why that show kind of fell apart, which I had never heard that story before, and I don't know whether that's true or somebody who just heard it through the grapevine. But fortunately for all of us, John Hillerman and Tom Selleck did not have that level
never
of magnetism on the pilot of Magnum P.I., so we were spared that.
Yes. Whew.
Lucky.
Rick and T.C., on the other hand, that was very, very tense between them for several years.
Agatha and Doc Eibold.
Oh, boy.
So I'm not gonna recount the plot of Murder by Night, because on one level it's ridiculous, and on another level it is a film noir plot where everybody's got a motive, and it leads to a conclusion that I really love that we'll get to at the end.
They literally have a scene that is straight out of Maltese Falcon with the creepiest cast member, Rick, playing the part of Joel Cairo. So well done.
And with a really good Shemp hairstyle that pops in black and white.
I felt like there were several moments where Rick, well, you know, Rick.
Rick.
We'll just call him Rick. He is channeling Elisha Cook Jr.
Oh yes,
right.
Oh, absolutely channeling Elisha Cook Jr.
Good job, Larry Minetti. I mean, you're no Bogart, but you're actually not a bad Elisha Cook Jr. Maybe you're hanging out with him a little bit, kind of rubbed off or something. But like,
and again,
it's very much like, oh, I'm in over my head. Oh no, now I'm dead.
I know they used him in the little teaser on AAPI.
Yeah,
but why do you not have Elisha Cook Jr.
I know,
in this episode?
Yeah.
What the hell are you doing?
I know, right? Like, was he not available to be the butler?
I mean, yeah.
Or even the dead body would have been a fun little cameo if he had been the dead body. So the premise of this episode is, it's not like, well, it is a dream, but it's also Magnum wrote a story, and he's sort of dream casting his people he knows, plus also other characters who were cast in this that are not people he knows, in a classic detective story. So Higgins is an attorney. He's a Texan attorney who is the attorney for this rich guy and his estate. John Hillerman gets to use something presumably at least approaching his real accent. It's probably not necessarily his actual real. I bumped into John Hillerman at the breakfast buffet accent.
Having seen him in Blazing Saddles, where, of course, he's being a Westerner, and also Chinatown, it's pretty close to the voice that he uses in those pictures.
Yeah.
Howard Johnson is right.
Yeah, he's a Texan, and he was a Texan, so that kind of follows.
Mr. Giddis, I don't know Rick, if the Department of Water and Power...
Rick is a priest or a reverend,
a minister. Minister,
a reverend.
He's got the collar.
He's got the clerical collar, but he can get married. So not a priest,
not a priest. I guess a reverend. He's going to get married
This is our new segment, priest or not.
to the daughter of the rich guy who dies in the opening.
Not even after Vatican II.
And then he visits Magnum's office later on, and there's a very funny, bizarre exchange there that we'll get to. TC is in this Inspector Wolf, who has been jousting with sparring with Magnum, had to give him an award and couldn't live that down. He's like, I'll get you, Magnum. And I think Roger E. Mosley delighting in playing this sort of scene chewing police inspector.
As we've said before in this show, the greatest gift in any Magnum episode is when Roger E. Moseley has to assume an identity that is not TC,
yes,
because he inevitably takes on a crazy voice.
Yes. Yes. I love him here. We extended with Inspector Wolf. And then Jeff McKay. Hey, Mac's back, except here he's not Mac.
He's not Mac, nor is he the other
fake
guy.
Mac. He is the coroner. He's Quincy M.E., basically. He's the coroner. Mm-hmm. And then we have some extra characters in here. We have the heiress. We have her daughter, who's played by Jennifer Runyon, who you may remember from, I don't know, she's the girl who guesses the cards in Ghostbusters. She's in the first season of Charles in Charge.
She was Cindy Brady's stand-in for a very Brady marriage, or Brady something.
Yeah, very Brady Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, whatever.
You'll recognize Jennifer Runyon. You will.
You got me. I don't know my Brady specials.
Or was it Brady something?
She's really Jennifer Runyon. If you don't remember the first season of Charles in Charge, which inexplicably. I do.
I do too.
I don't know why, but
this
I do.
Not surprising.
But. This is not surprising, but you remember the scene where we find out that Bill Murray is an awful person at the opening of Ghostbusters, where the one guy seems to be guessing what all of the ESP cards are and gets electric shocks, and the pretty blonde girl guesses them all wrong, but Bill Murray tells her she's a legitimate phenomenon because she knows all these things. That girl is Jennifer Runyon. So now you know. That's the daughter of the rich guy who dies in the opening scene. And then
new boy in the neighborhood lives upstairs. It's the theme to Charles in Charge.
Charles
that
in
I know.
Charles in Charge of our days and our nights.
Yeah. Charles in Charge of our wrongs
and our rights. And I'll see.
Let's see.
I want Charles in charge of me. Okay, we got it. That
Get
was the second
Charles
I didn't
Aoki.
Expect. Also, Phyllis Davis, who played, what does he call her?
In this, she's Precious, but her name is
he
Tiffy.
He calls her Precious in the previous, where there's like a little dream about this. She does have a name that he calls her later, Tiffy. She's the secretary, right? She's the secretary for Thomas Magnum, private investigator. So,
which again, tip of the hat to Effie Perrine, Sam Spade's secretary.
And then Henry Jones is playing the butler. The butler is a character. I think one, it's funny that they don't have John Hillerman play the butler, and then instead they have the butler. And there is a moment where later on in the episode where I think, oh my God, did the butler really do it? But the butler doesn't do it. The butler, that's not what they're doing with the butler.
Before we go on,
yes,
another segment.
Oh,
the Urich parallels.
Okay,
because Phyllis Davis played the Secretary B on Vegas, where Robert Urich was private detective Dan Tana, lived at the generosity of a rich man and solved crimes for him, which sounds strangely
I've got another
familiar.
Robert Urich connection.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
In 1989, Robert Urich was in a TV movie. Do you like to know what it was called?
I would.
Murder by Night.
There you go.
It was based on the short story by Thomas Magnum.
Thomas Sullivan Magnum. Yes.
The pieces all come together.
Wow. There is an interesting parallel between the two of them for most of their careers. And they even starred in a pilot together in the late 70s before Magnum or Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Bunko.
So
it's not awful, the plot here, it's not good.
The plot here is that the rich guy died and Rick was there.
But he was not
the killer. He hid. The guy seems to be dead, and this is all comes back at the end.
Classic Rick.
Yeah, hide behind. Magnum doesn't hide. We established that last week. But Rick hides, and then somebody beats him
he's
to death.
He's a tiny guy.
Except when we find out that he's dead, he's plunged to his death. So he seemed to be dead already. He's then battered about the head with some object he smashed with. And yet he died a third time. I was amused by that because that's like adding to the ridiculous twistiness and noiriness of it. We get John Hillerman threatening Magnum in a different way, and he like pays him off and says like this is done. We get the twisty turny, like the girl was gonna marry Rick's character, but then he dies.
Or she did.
She did, but it's going to be annulled.
But the father's going to have it annulled.
Because she gets the money if she's married and doesn't get it if she isn't. There's a whole thing going on here. Some great stuff though, where Reverend Rick comes to Magnum's office and demands these documents. And there's also a lot of looping in this scene. There's a lot of bad audio recording in this episode. A lot of noise, weird stage noises and echoes and stuff like that. But they're doing their best to make this up. They obviously spent a lot of money redressing a bunch of their sets because the daughter lives in the guest house, which is very clearly a redress of Magnum's guest house apartment, right down to the staircase. So there's a bunch of fun stuff like that where they're redressing their existing sets in order to fit into this story. He threatens Magnum. With a gun. There's a punch. It leads to a classic line from Larry Minetti, which is, "Look what you did to my tunic." That's amazing.
Again. Echoing Maltese Falcon with, "Look what you did to my shirt."
Yeah, but it's a tunic.
But it's a tunic.
Extra level. And then it leads to a hilarious moment where Magnum's like, "Okay, listen, this is what it's going to be, and you just get out of here." And he's like, "Well, can I have my gun?" And Magnum's like, "Yeah, you can have your gun." And he immediately holds it back up and says, "Now give me the things." I'm like, come on, really? But what happens is that then he's shot from outside and is dead because it's, you know, it's like that character. He's dead, and a car drives away, and it's like it's the wife's, the widow's car. But when they ask who was driving it, they say that it was the lawyer, so Higgins basically. The daughter puts the moves on Magnum. There's a great moment where she says, "I can make all your dreams come true," and he says, "Yeah, I bet you could." And he kisses her, but while he's kissing her, he steals an object that he's noticed that she was sort of sniffing earlier in order to use for evidence. But basically, and then Wolf TC, Roger E. Mosley, comes to the Magnum office with the cops, and he's like, "Oh yes," it's a great moment where Magnum's like, "Oh yes, you're right. I did kill him. He pulled a gun on me. And what I did was then I went downstairs and went outside and shot him in the back. That's totally what I did. Come on." Stupid. What are you thinking? But the other than just loving all the references to classic film noir things, the thing that I love about this episode the most is it ends with your typical murder mystery parlor scene where...
Yes, I've gathered all you here today.
Because one of you is the killer.
Painstakingly explained.
Oh my God. And it's so good.
In my notes for a radio theater episode, I do have the line, "Welcome to my denouement party."
Yeah. It's so good.
Because that's exactly what it is.
Because first off, I laugh because it's the law of conservation of characters. These are the only characters in the episode. So clearly one of them is the murderer.
Yes. Spoiler alert, it's not going to be Scrungeo. Also no Scrungeo.
Also no Scrungeo in this. No flashback version of Scrungeo, if only. That's been our Scrungeo segment. Anyway, what I love also is that Magnum goes through the people one by one, and each of them he explains very clearly why they were involved in the murder and why they must be the murderer. And they're like, "But I wasn't the murderer." And he says, no. You're not the murderer. And he moves on to the next one, and they're like, "Oh, no. Now this person's the murderer." And he repeats it over and over again until he's covered everybody. And
this is basically Red Face Thespian, only not played for straight laughs like that one was.
Although it's still really funny, but there gets the moment where the butler has been watching all this from the corner. I'm like, "Oh no, was it the butler?" And then no, he doubles back and says, "No, but it actually was you who actually killed this, because you put poison in his tea. And you are actually the murderer because," and he explains it all, and that's all fine.
For those who want the explanation,
yes,
but
the daughter poisoned him to death.
Mm-hmm.
The mother, realizing that he was dead, bludgeoned him to make it look like the daughter killed him, thus she would forfeit her inheritance.
Yes,
and the Higgins, who
the attorney
is secretly in love with the daughter, throws the body out the window to make it look like a suicide so that he can marry the daughter later on.
And get all the money.
Right.
So they are all supposed to be arrested for murder.
Right, which is the great last line is that, because you know, Inspector Wolf, TC, is there. And then he's like, so they're all guilty of, and he actually says, "Book 'em," Book 'em All and Spectre, which is a nice Hawaii 5-0 reference to Murder One and Accessory. And that reveals why the butler is there, is because if they're all guilty of the murder, who gets the money? Zoom in on the butler. I guess the butler gets the money. I don't know.
And he realizes it. That's a wonderful moment.
Mm. Yeah.
Henry Jones.
Yeah.
Henry Jones.
I don't know. I mean, so that's the black and white segment here. How did you guys like it? I mean, it's a trifle, but it's fun, and it's all things that are familiar, and it's twisty turny, and everybody's a red herring, but also a suspect, and in the end, they're all sort of guilty, which is kind of fun.
So I like the nods to your Maltese Falcons, or outright lifts from Maltese Falcon, and the big sleep and all that, because I like film noir, I like detective movies. They play it a little too straight for my taste.
Yep.
Particularly the scenes between Magnum and Higgins or Selleck and Hillerman. You would think that there would be a little bit of knowing nods and winks and elbows and those two playing off each other, but you don't get that here. You get like, I'm an angry lawyer and I'm gonna, I want you off the property.
Yeah, it's much more like first season Magnum Higgins dynamic, whereas the TC Inspector Wolf dynamic with Magnum is that, right? Jousting, hilarious, ludicrous kind of back and forth, and you don't get that from Hillerman.
I wanted a little touch more silliness in it, or a little bit more with them looking at the audience going, yeah, we know we're doing a thing. It's the seventh season. What do you want from us?
Honestly, that's what I like about that last scene, is the last scene is so ludicrous, where everybody thinks they're guilty and everybody thinks they're not guilty, and TC is there going like, huh, what?
Yeah.
that scene is exactly the tone that the whole episode should probably have.
Yeah.
That was the potential there. And, you know, in 1987, I loved this episode. I loved that they went to the trouble to do it. I loved that they played it so straight. And in 2021, I'm looking at it and going, you played it too straight.
Too straight.
Yeah.
There's no joy in it. And, you know, I know they were really into the whole hard-boiled PI thing. And I look at it, and we talked about this when with Margaret Collin on the show, but especially with Annie Potts, with Dana Delaney, you could have done this with anyone. Instead of Sam Spade, do Nick Charles. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, how much more fun would that have been?
I also think this is not the kind of show you want guest stars appearing on screen for any sort of time. And you have that with two of the central characters and people we don't know. You want people who are regularly part of the cast to appear as the wife and the daughter, which I mean, I guess is Agatha Chumley and
Carol.
Oh boy.
Margaret Collins' character is off on the side for seven seasons.
That was foreplay on their part not to introduce more beloved female characters. Uh-huh. Mm. So that when this show was in its death throes, then and they do their fantasy show. Oh, well, we have to bring in ladies because otherwise it's just a bunch
also,
of dudes.
But I will say, I will say I enjoy watching them play against type, and they are at least the three of them are clearly having a lot of fun, and Selleck gets to be the tough guy, but you know, Hillerman and Minetti and Mosley are all having fun with what they're doing.
Oh, sure.
And it's like the first time they get to do something totally different in 7 years.
My wife's criticism, because she watched it with me last night, was that if we come to accept that the best thing about Tom Selleck as Thomas Magnum is he's a big goofball and he is at his best when he's reacting and going, huh, what, how is this happening to me? And you don't get that here. You get basically why Tom Selleck was not a successful movie actor, and that people go, well, you're very handsome and rugged, so be handsome and rugged and less goofy.
Yeah.
And so,
see, and again, that's why Nick Charles would have been a better choice.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. That totally would have played to his strengths.
Or at the very least,
and you could still do everything else.
You got to do, have this plot, but have it be a little more bantery and all that. And that's actually going to be my criticism of the casting. I think it's the same thing, which is that you don't have women in the regular recurring set of players who can play these parts. So they cast Antwumi and Jennifer Runyon. But
and they're fine.
They're fine,
you don't have any connection.
I think it's a problem. I mean, maybe it's a problem with the script because they've got him sort of romancing Alicia, the wife, but also kissing the daughter. But I kind of wanted, I don't know, I wanted either you bulk up Alicia's part and you have them be giving banter where you're like, they've known each other a long time and maybe they're not romantically involved, but they are emotionally involved and connected and they're giving it to each other as good as they've gotten in dialogue. Yeah. Or you really play up in the Christine part, in Jennifer Runyon's part, you play up that character being like super messed up ne'er-do-well daughter, like in The Big Sleep, right?
Yeah.
But they mute both of those, and I think that either of those would have given Tom Selleck more to do, but neither of those relationships are really, like, the three women, because we'll throw in Tiffy, the secretary, like, none of those really crackles, and that's what you want if you're gonna give Tom Selleck something to do, is you really need some lightning in a bottle with one of those relationships, and none of them really are that interesting.
And they're, you know, they could have done a better job with Tiffy, and that would have been an interesting thing. But again, you know, it just
she's playing that part, and I'm okay with that. Like, that role, yeah, I think, is a very well-defined private detective secretary who really loves him. And do they have a relationship? Well, sort of, but sort of not. But like, for the other two sort of femme fatales here, neither of them is that interesting. Nothing. And it's almost like they're trying to split the difference between them because they want both of them for the plot to work. But like, as a result, neither of them really works with Magnum.
And I do like that instead of just being a secretary who sits around the office, he does tell her, you know, hey, can you go down and do this?
Oh, yeah.
And
he gives her a list of
investigate this
legwork to do. I did like that.
You know, and it's like, all right, that's a nice touch.
Yeah. So at the end, what we get is, and on the home video version, it's so confusing because now it's in black and white. It is Magnum wakes up and Higgins has read his short story about the murder.
When he's in his classic, you know, the Hawaiian shirt, the short shorts, the Detroit Tigers cap. So we know it's Magnum again.
Yes. And it's Murder by Night. And Higgins is like, I love it. This is the best. It's like one of the greatest things I've ever read. It's amazing.
It's like Dashiell Hammett. But if you had a blend of Raymond Chandler and Earl Stanley Gardner in there, and even a Susan of Agatha Christie, it's amazing.
Yes.
And that's when Thomas goes,
excuse me.
Oh,
I'm still dreaming. Oh, and goes back to bed. At which point he wakes up and he looks around and he says, oh, black and white. This is a, it wakes up and it's in color and Higgins is there trying to get him. It's like, Magnum, you got to get up and all this. And then, and you see in this moment, you see him almost try to show his story to Higgins. And he's like,
it's because Higgins says, why, you know, you wanted me to come here. Why did you want me to get here? Wake up. What's going on?
Yeah.
And Magnum is like, oh, I was going to show you this. And he finally looks right at the camera and goes, nah.
Yeah. Nah. The end. So that's...
And a sheet flutters down. Murder by Night. That, and it goes to black and white again.
With the 1940 style credits, with the players. And
which
and
is then, so, it's so lovely.
And it's the rare Magnum PI credits, mid-credits stinger, with Magnum reading that detective novel in costume as his 1940s detective guy, smoking and then coughing horribly. Because, of course, Thomas Selleck does not enjoy the cigarettes.
No, and he stabs it out violently.
Yes.
I have in my notes so much smoking.
Yeah, well, it's,
everybody's smoking
it's
like
noir.
A chimney.
I get it.
Because that's what you do. But it's nice that that moment is, again, in color. And in 1987, it was in color,
all right,
too. Which, again, weird. But
so
it's a great moment to be like, oh, so, see, I'm cool with
my wife wanted bloops and things to be there, but no.
My complaint about this, because there's no bloops because they took it way too seriously.
Yeah, exactly.
My other complaint about this is I wanted the orchestral Magnum PI theme.
Yep.
Right? Instead, and I like that they did music that you would hear in a film noir, but I'm disappointed that they didn't take the Magnum PI theme and play with it for those credits at the end, and they just didn't.
It was, but you know, it was still that time where TV shows were like, no, we can't
yeah,
do
except
everything.
They went
until
so
Moonlighting
far,
started
they
doing
went
that.
So far as to do completely different credits, right?
Right.
They and I figure if they went that far, I'm disappointed that they didn't also do Orchestral Magnum, but they didn't.
Yeah.
Well, yes, I think in the end, this is a fun episode, but also a little disappointing because it's not much more. Like I said, it's a trifle. It's like, it's fun. I get what they're doing here, but I feel like it's very clear that it could have been better. It could have been more, but it's okay.
Yeah, I mean, I still love it. It's still probably one of my favorite Magnum episodes because they do it well. They get the tone of what they're doing. I have just come to the point where I would have preferred more of that Nick and Nora tone instead of the Sam Spade.
I hear you.
But they nailed it.
Time and time again, you really get the impression that everyone who worked on Magnum PI loved movies of a certain era.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
And this is also Robert Hamilton coming back after several years away from Magnum. Mm. And his scripts, if you look at a lot of his scripts, they are kind of lurching towards doing this, right? This is not a surprise because he's the one who did the one where the woman insists that Magnum dress is the 40s PI, right?
Right.
And he did another one that was, you know, all drenched in 40s PI stuff. And so, yeah, this is not a surprise coming from him.
No, and it's also, I will say, 1980s availability of these movies and awareness of these movies was not what it is today.
Yeah, had to come across them by chance on syndicated,
right, or go to a revival, live in a city where there was a house that was doing a revival of something on a weekend or something, like the. Again and again with Magnum watching old movies on TV, I'm struck by the fact that the people who made this, like you said, David, they love classic movies and they love referencing classic movies on the show, but it's worn like a badge of honor. Like I'm in a secret society who's aware of classic movies in a way that I just don't think as people in 2021 we would ever think of that. It's like, well, yeah, I mean, you can just go watch those movies.
Like he's like, hey, look, I found a videotape of Stalag 17. Hey, I can call it up on YouTube right now.
Yeah, exactly. Anything else about this episode, Murder by Night? Nope.
Well,
yes.
Tangentially.
Oh, no. Okay. Segment.
Tangentially.
Okay, David.
We have a segment.
Oh, no.
Is it black and white Lego time?
Magnum. Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. God.
Here we have.
Into the mouth of Magnum we go.
If it'll ever load, go in there. Into the Zoom chat, we have Magnum holding Rick at gunpoint.
All right. Okay. That looks more like Christian Bale, but okay.
You know, you do what you can. And
this is the original 1987 version and not the syndicated version then.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Because it is in black and white.
With film grain.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I did this right. Come on, go in the chat. There we go. And I am so happy.
This is also our segment, Man Loads Photos into Zoom.
Yeah. It's everybody's favorite.
I'm so happy that I basically found a Maltese Falcon.
Well, sure.
So,
or an owl.
It's an owl. But, you know, it's a black owl. It's in the right pose. It's perfect.
Sure.
It's the Legos the dreams are made of.
Uh-huh.
That's right.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that segment where David talked about pictures that you can see if you work on it.
Just
gotta,
you know,
gotta
they're there.
Through.
They're there.
And that brings us to the end of this episode of Magnum Podcast. Mm. As always, I have been your host and gumshoe, Jason Snell, and they have also been your hosts, David J. Lohr and Philip Michaels. Bye, guys.
I love you both, but I won't play the sap for you.
I've called you all here today to accuse you of being excellent co-hosts. I really enjoyed myself.
You'll never take me alive, see?